Questioning Paul, Chapter 12, Part 4.
Here now is the conclusion of CHABAQUWQ 2, verse 17.
As a result of the blood of humankind, and also this grievous injustice against and blatant wrongdoing in opposition to the land, the city, and all of her inhabitants. Habakkuk 2, verse 17.
Keep in mind that during the Magog War, Satan's little helpers, motivated by their religion, will annihilate more than half of the world's population in their failed assault on Israel. Then a couple of years later, politically, militaristically, and economically motivated men and women will return to finish what the Muslims will have failed to achieve. They will raise havoc in the land, ravaging Jerusalem, killing two-thirds of the remaining Israelite population. So before they are shattered, there will lots of bloodshed at the behest of the adversary. In this case, either of our two renderings of Kyria apply because the Eretz, land, is Israel and the Kyria, city, is Yesity, Yerushalayim. It is the place where we encounter Yet, and also the place where we find the foundation, beams, and furnishings, associated with his covenant and word.
How does he succeed with a caricature? Indeed, he will construct him, fashioning him by offering a veiled form of a pagan god and by teaching lies, so that he adds credence and partiality to the one who created the construct of him, for him to make the shepherds bound and mute. Habakkuk 2 verse 18.
There is another discrepancy here between the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Masoretic text worth noting. Rather than saying fashioning him by offering the veiled form of a pagan god and by teaching lies, the Qumran scrolls read, by making a deceptive appearance, which is an invalid manifestation. There are a number of additional clues in this statement, all of which point to Shaul. First, God is Ma, questioning him, a reference to Shaul's name and to what we all should be doing. Second, Shaul created a pisel, caricature, of Yahusha, one which bore very little in common with the Messiah. Third, Paul's Isu was not only a Mesca, veiled version of the pagan god, Dionysus, his Christu was Yatsar, devised, to Mesca, conceal the true identity, of Yahusha, by covering up, his nature and purpose. Fourth, each time the Pauline caricature, offering, and construct, is presented, we find the third person masculine singular suffix, making this the image of a man and not a thing. Moreover, there is only one of him, something wholly incongruous with pagan idolatry. Fifth, sincera, teaching, instruction, direction and guidance, is the verb upon which title Torah is based. We find Shaul promoting the Torah which is sheker, deceptive, misleading, mistaken, and useless. And sixth, the full implications of Batach are especially Pauline. It reveals that Paul's deceptive guidance regarding the caricature he devised Batach would cause the unsuspecting and naive to stumble and fall based upon what they were led to believe. And this leads us to the final phrase which is no less revealing. The combination of Yatsar Yetzer following Batach was translated the one who created the construct of him, because the verb was scribed in the masculine singular, the one, and the noun was written to include the third person masculine singular suffix, him. This is relevant because God's statement is saying that Shaul's false characterization of Yahusha was created to make Shaul appear more credible, not Yahusha. The phony construct was devised because Shaul wanted readers to believe him. Shaul wanted all those he encountered to show partiality toward the one who conceived the false god, Isu Christu, causing the unsuspecting to stumble over him while praising him. Lastly, Alalim can be rendered two very different ways, as idols, or shepherds. And while Shaul effectively muted Yahusha's voice, with his letters overriding him, Alalim was written in the plural form, disassociating it from Shaul or his caricature. Further, since this is presented in Yahusha's voice, he would never refer to Yahusha as an idol, even if the plural form have not been used. But, we know that Yahusha routinely deployed the shepherd metaphor to convey Yahusha's nature and purpose. 1 Yahusha, developed even further. Also, Yahusha specifically asked Shimon Kephas, the rock, to shepherd his sheep, explaining the use of the plural form. And in that discussion, Yahusha warned Shimon that Shaul would attempt to bind and tie him, so as to constrain his ability to care for God's sheep. And in doing so, we are afforded yet another clue linking this prophecy with the plague of death. Also interesting in this regard, the two most common Hebrew words featuring the YHWH combination, the letters following L/L, Almighty God, in Aldam, noting also that the YHWH suffix denotes plural, Yalad, children, and Yalak, walking. And that makes Aldam, children who walk with God.
Woe to the one who said to the wooden pillar, return from the dead, rising up to blind by providing false testimony and precluding further observation, to the rock, he who consistently teaches, be silent. Behold, he has actually been seized, captured, controlled, and then covered, brilliantly shimmering, extremely valuable and desirable, but without any spirit in his midst. Habakkuk 2 verse 19.
Shaul has repeatedly stated that the wooden pillar, more commonly known as the Christian cross, was the means to be quotes, awakened from the dead, or to be resurrected, in religious parlance. He even equated sleep with death and spoke of those who were sleeping rising up abruptly. So the initial statement is an allusion to the Pauline fixation on the wooden cross, from which he promotes resurrection from the dead. With quotes scribed in the hippal stem, imperative mood, and paragogic form, Yahweh is revealing that Shaul will show his desire to control the upright pillar, commanding him into action, demanding that he abruptly rise from the dead to perform based upon Shaul's inclinations. And as bad as that appears, it gets far worse with the addition of Ur, which suggests that Shaul contrived his variation of bodily resurrection following death on the cross to provide false testimony which would blind, precluding further observation. This trend continues south with the desire to double them, silence, the Eben Ha'ira, the rock, he who consistently teaches and instructs. While this is yet another reference to Shaul's desire to moot Shimon Kephas, the disciple, one who learns and thus can teach, the ultimate Yura, source of teaching and instruction, is the rock of our salvation, Yahweh manifest as Yahusha. And as a result of Shaul's mischaracterization of Yahusha, Christians have been blinded, no longer observing Yahusha's message or Yahweh's Torah, effectively silencing God. The contrivance Shaul seized upon and controlled was made to appear valuable, even glorious and desirable, but with this corpse, there is no spirit. And such is the case with the Passover lamb. The spirit departed prior to the death of the physical body, and the remaining corpse in accordance with the Torah's instructions was destroyed that same night. God was not killed and his body was not resurrected. But, pretending this to be so became the basis of Pauline Christianity.
And so Yahweh, in his set apart, brilliant, prevailing, and enduring temple, be silent and stop speaking before his presence and appearance all on the earth. Habakkuk 2 verse 20.
We have done more talking than listening, more contriving than observing. So Yahweh is recommending that the likes of Paul shut up. He has said far too much already. And yet sadly, every time a Christian opens their New Testament to one of Paul's epistles and recites it aloud, the hideous voice of the adversary continues to resonate on earth. It should be noted that Haeckel affirms that Yahweh is fully capable of delivering on his promises, and thus not impotent as Shaul has cast him. Moreover, the word following Haeckel, brilliant, prevailing, enduring, capable, empowering, and enlightening, in most every Hebrew lexicon and dictionary is Hillel, the ruler of Babylon, also known as Satan. The adversary's name means bears light, confirming that as a spiritual being he would appear to glow, just as Paul saw him. And this is how Satan came to be rendered into Latin as Lucifer, the light bearer. What follows is a wonderful affirmation of what Yahweh has done for us, of his reliability, and of his willingness to personally and mercifully engage so that we might live. But to understand any of this, we have to stop talking and start listening.
A request for intervention concerning CHABAQUWQ, the Prophet, on behalf of the Almighty's exceedingly great growth. Habakkuk 3 verse 2, Yahweh, I have actually listened to the entirety of your announced message. I respect and revere, Yahweh, your work in the midst of the years. You make known that he will live and restore life throughout the middle years in turmoil, making your mercy known. Habakkuk 3 verse 2.
According to Yahweh, he worked 6 days and then he rested on the seventh. These 6 plus 1 days represent the 7,000-year history of mankind that have and will transpire from the moment we were expelled from the Garden of Eden to the time we are invited back inside. In year 2000, 1968 BCE, God initiated a covenant with Abraham. And in year 4000, 33 CE, God did his greatest work, fulfilling and enabling the first 4 microi, Pesach, Matzah, Picturim, and Shavuot, noting that his work began in 0 year and concludes in 6000 year, 2000 year and 4000 year are the middle years.
From the right hand of God, he will actually come, and the set apart one from the Mount of Glorification / Paran. Pause a moment to weigh the uplifting implications. He adorns the spiritual realm in his splendor and glory. So with his love and renown she fills up and completely satisfies the earth. Habakkuk 3 verse 3.
Yahusha is the right hand of God, he is the set apart one, and he is the living embodiment of the path away from being abused by mankind's religious and political institutions and to God, so that we can live with him in the promised land. This is the way of the Micrae. It is the guidance the Torah provides. As such, Paran represents the mountainous desert along both sides of the Gulf of Aqaba, and thus between the Sinai and Arabian peninsulas. The region encompasses most all of the noted encampments during the Exodus on the western side and also Mount Horeb, where the Torah was revealed, along the eastern shore. It is in this way that Yahweh's set-apart spirit supplies God's love, reveals his glory, adorns us in a garment of light, fills our needs, and completely satisfies. She also serves to enlighten us.
And also knowledge and enlightenment consistent with the light, she exists as brilliant shining rays of illumination coming forth from his hand on his behalf. And here, his name is his fortified and mighty covering of love. Habakkuk 3 verse 4.
It's a lot to give up just to flirt with Paul. I have enjoyed this voyage through Yahweh's prophetic witness. It is always a pleasure and a good idea to check in with God when seeking answers to important questions. His perspective on Paul's matters, and his verdict is in fact conclusive, irrefutable, and damning. In the Torah, and specifically in Deuteronomy 13, Yahweh tells us that if a self-proclaimed prophet stands up, establishing himself, as Paulus has done, he is a false prophet. If he claims to have performed miracles as proof of his calling, as Paulus has done, he is a false prophet. If he encourages his audience to accept other gods by other names, like the Roman Grasha or Greek Teres, even the Babylonian Lord, all of whom Paulus sponsored, he is a false prophet. If he encourages religious worship, which is the legacy of Paulus's letters, he is a false prophet. If his writings don't affirm our love of Yahweh, the God whose words and plan Paulus has called incompetent, impotent, and enslaving, he is a false prophet. If he directs us to disregard the terms and conditions of the covenant or the pact Yahweh has provided for our salvation, he is a false prophet. And of such self-proclaimed prophets, God says that they are in opposition to him, both ruinous and deadly, so we should completely remove their disagreeable, displeasing, and evil corruptions from our midst.
With regard to every word which beneficially I am instructing you with accordingly, observe it for the purpose of engaging in and acting upon it, not adding to it and not subtracting from it. Indeed, if a prophet stands up trying to establish himself in your midst or an interpreter of revelations, and provides a sign or miracle to you, and the Omanod miracle worker appears before you who has spoken thusly to you to say, let us go after other gods which you have not known and let us serve and worship them. Do not listen to the words of that prophet or interpreter of revelations, because the test of Yahweh, your God, accordingly for you to know is whether this affirms your love for Yahweh, your God, with all your heart and with all your soul. After Yahweh, your God, you should walk, and with him, you should always and genuinely be respectful, and in concert with his terms and conditions, you should continually and actually be observant. Concerning his voice, you should always and literally listen so that, with him, you can consistently serve, and to him, you should always choose to cling. So therefore, that prophet or interpreter of revelations is deadly. For indeed he has spoken rebellious renunciations concerning and against Yahweh, your God, the one who led you out from the realm of the crucibles of Egypt and the one who redeemed you from the house of bondage and slavery. His desire is to seduce and scatter you from the way which beneficially, Yahweh, your God, described, providing you with a complete set of directions for you to walk in. And so you can choose to completely remove that which is disagreeable, displeasing, and evil from your midst. Deuteronomy 13 verses 1 to 6.
The intent of Galatians wasn't just to subtract God's advice on his covenant and its sign, circumcision. It was also promoted to completely negate the purpose of the invitations to be called out and meet with God. Paul strove to negate the Torah's entire purpose, diminishing its status to the point that it would be considered a liability rather than an asset. Paul's condescending and antagonistic dismissal of Yahweh's Torah teaching and its covenant wouldn't engender love or respect for the God who authored and offered them. Therefore, the only way to cling to Paul would be to let go of God. God says that no one has been or will be authorized to add to or subtract from his Torah. Therefore, if we witness the Torah's role in our lives being diminished, or if we find the writer adding something new, like a new covenant, be careful because such a person isn't speaking for God. This realization alone is game over for Christianity. Yahweh has reinforced a simple, yet profound, truth. Once we take the Torah seriously, closely examining and carefully considering its guidance, we can no longer take Paul seriously. Paul's letters are the antithesis of Yahweh's Torah, and for that reason alone it would be wholly ignorant and irrational to believe Paul. Yahweh revealed that the best way to know who isn't speaking for him is to closely examine and carefully consider every word the self-proclaimed prophet and God have written. If they differ, the man is a liar. Therefore, knowing and understanding God's Torah comes first. Then, compare what Yahweh said to what the prophet is claiming. If they differ, expose and condemn the false prophet and encourage others to disassociate themselves from him. Simultaneously, it is always a good idea to act upon God's guidance. So if you haven't already done so, consider acting upon the terms and conditions of the covenant relationship. Since opinions are to conclusions as faith is to trust, and since we have at our fingertips another way to determine with absolute certainty whether or not Paul was speaking for Yahweh or for himself, there is no reason for us to presume anything. Here is God's secondary means to determine the veracity of a witness.
Surely, the person who proclaims a message on behalf of a deity who oversteps their bounds and speaks presumptuously and contemptuously for the express purpose of conveying a statement in my name which accordingly I have not expressly appointed, taught, guided, nor entirely directed him to speak, and who speaks in the name of other gods, indeed, then that prophet, he is deadly. Deuteronomy 18 verse 20.
Therefore, Yahweh's second test is a relatively simple one. It contains six elements, with six being the number of man.
Is the person a Nabi? Someone who claims to speak on behalf of God?
This is a screening codicil. If a person admits that they are speaking for themselves, then they would be excluded from this analysis. The evaluation, therefore, does not apply to Obama but would apply to Osama. Paul's favorite line, "but I say to you," would ordinarily have been sufficient to exclude him from this test, and thereby also exclude his epistles from consideration, because by repeating this phrase, he was admitting that he was speaking for himself and not for God. But since he was duplicitous and often vowed that he had been personally selected and authorized to speak for God, he subjects himself to God's test. And yet, he has already failed the first codicil. And that is because the preponderance of Paul's message was delivered under the banner of "but I say," instead of "Yahweh says." That should have been more than sufficient to disqualify Paul as God's agent. So it is strike one. Where one strike is deadly.
Is the person zaid, someone who oversteps their bounds, acting presumptuously with an inflated sense of self-worth, demonstrating self-reliance while taking liberties, someone who arrogantly pretends to know, who insults others and is disrespectful, displaying pride in the pursuit of personal recognition and acclaim while demeaning competitors, someone who rebels against the legitimate authority and is prone to anger, someone who seethes with frustration and is often furious, overbearing, rude, or conceited?
Shaul has insulted Shimon, Jacob, and Yahalchanan, in addition to Yahweh/Yahusha. His claim to the world as if it was his personal domain has been overbearing and presumptuous. His assertion that he was incapable of lying and that he was the perfect example to follow were conceited in the extreme. He has been rude to the Galatians and disrespectful of most everyone, consistently misquoting God's word and then twisting it. And he has routinely shown great contempt for the Torah, consistently demeaning it. Strike 2.
Does the person any shame, openly and publicly preach to others, communicating their message in the name of God?
As was the case with the first codicil, this is also a screening test. If the individual in question has an insignificantly small audience, if their preaching is done in private, if their influence is limited in time and place, then there would be no reason to assess their credentials. But Paul begins his epistle bragging that he was speaking for God, not men. He claims to have had his own private session with God. This, along with the fact that Paul's preaching in the book of Acts and his letters comprise half of the Christian New Testament, and that his words are quoted more often by Christians than God's, puts a bullseye on Paul. Strike 3.
Is the person's message lotsawa, inconsistent with what God has instructed and directed? Does the message conflict with what God appointed, constituted, and decreed? Does it vary from his instructions?
Galatians, like Romans, is an attack on the Torah. As such, Paul's letters represent the most extreme breach of Yahweh's fourth test. The only thing worse than advocating ideas which are extraneous to God's witness is to promote things which contradict his testimony. Paul's repudiation of the Torah, combined with his replacement theology, which is essentially comprised of believing him, is therefore an egregious and deadly violation of God's fourth test. It is also a direct violation of the third of three statements Yahweh etched upon the first of the two stone tablets, for which there is no forgiveness. Strike 4.
Does the person dabah be a shem of Elohim, speak in the name of gods other than Yahweh?
Paul's Gospel of Grace, Juris/Gratia, elevates the Greek and Roman pagan goddesses above Yahweh, and in his parting comment, Paul excludes Yahweh's name and signs off in the moniker of the Egyptian sun god, Amen. He also revealed a proclivity for addressing his God as the Lord. This is strike 5 in a life and death encounter where one strike is fatal.
Does the person accurately convey what is happening and what has happened in the past, and do their predictions of the future materialize and come to exist as they have stated them?
Paul's errant portrayal of the Yerushalm summit is an undeniable breach of the Hayyah clause, as was his testimony regarding his contradictory accounts of his conversion experience and his mythical trip to Arabia. The fact that there were no prophecies in Galatians, a false prophecy regarding his personal inclusion in the trumpet's harvest in his second letter, and no fulfilled predictions in any of his other letters, serve as an undeniable breach of the bow clause of this codicil. So since Paul's demonic source of inspiration was incapable of properly guiding his false prophet, it is strike 6. Therefore, it is off to Sheol for Sheol, and if you believe him, your soul will be destroyed at the end of your mortal life. That is why this test exists. Yahweh, as we know, proved that he inspired the Torah, prophets, and Psalms by punctuating his words with prophetic predictions, all of which came true, or are coming true, just as he had revealed. Since only God has seen the future, he isn't actually predicting it, but instead reporting in advance what he actually knows will occur. That's why he is always right, and it's why he uses prophecy to demonstrate that his testimony is reliable.
End of part 4.